From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd, in for Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. World leaders are reacting to President Trump's decision to withdraw the United States from the Paris Climate Accord. Here's French President Emmanuel Macron.
I do think it is an actual mistake, both for the U.S. and for our planet.
So how is the decision playing in this country? Let's get to our weekly political roundtable.
Jesse Holland is with the Associated Press. Hi, Jesse.
How you doing?
And Chad Pergram, who covers Congress for Fox News, is here too. Hi, Chad.
Great to be with you.
Chad, let's start with you. Here's the president speaking yesterday, laying out his reasons for pulling out of the Paris deal.
At what point does America get demeaned? At what point do they start laughing at us as a country? We want fair treatment for its citizens, and we want fair treatment for our taxpayers. We don't want other leaders and other countries laughing at us anymore, and they won't be. They won't be.
So, Chad, stark contrast there between how French President Macron says his country sees the pullout and then how Trump says foreign leaders will actually perceive this. What are your thoughts on it?
Well, this is a trend that we're seeing in global politics right now of isolationism. We've seen this to some degree in Europe with Brexit and even Scottish independence. This is an issue here that President Trump talked about on the campaign trail, and he's making good on that. The question is whether or not this will, you know, get coal jobs back in West Virginia and those places, Western Pennsylvania, places, I should add, that he performs so well. And now he's getting an earful from the left, probably similar to what the French leader said here. The House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi has long said that climate change is her, quote, flagship issue. And she said at her press conference, quote, how are you going to explain this to your grandchildren, Mr. President? And she said, almost every schoolchild knows more about climate change than the president. He lives in a fact-free zone.
Well, and we heard just today from Larry Summers, the former Treasury Secretary, the former economic advisor to President Obama. And here's what he said.
I believe it's the biggest U.S. foreign policy error since the Iraq War. And its consequences will be of even longer duration.
And then we also spoke yesterday, before the decision was made, with the Republican Oklahoma Senator James Inhofe about the accord. Here's what he had to say.
It constitutes probably the largest tax increase in the history of America, and you don't get anything for it.
Jesse, you hear the two sides there. Obviously, President Trump went with the Republican view there from James Inhofe and others.
Well, like Chad said, this is something that he had talked about for a long time. But one of the interesting things we see now on this is that the actual cities in America are breaking away from the federal government on this issue. In fact, 70 cities around the country have said they're going to go with the Paris Accords on their own, even without federal help. So even with President Trump saying America is going to pull out of this, you have American politicians on the ground in the city saying we're going to go ahead anyway.
Jesse, does that matter? Can these cities actually make a difference with these policies?
Well, okay, now you're getting into a whole nother subject, because the Republicans will say, well, what beyond a quote unquote tax increase did the Paris Accords give America anyway? So yes, these cities think they can move ahead and actually make a difference on their own, regardless of what the federal government says. The question will be is, are they actually right?
It almost strikes me, too, that this is a situation where President Trump felt that he had to go big. Remember on the campaign trail, he talked about completely withdrawing from NAFTA. He didn't do that. Again, that is an issue that holds a lot of sway with his voters in those rural areas, those steel country areas in West Virginia and Western Pennsylvania and Northern Ohio that I talked about a little bit ago. He didn't go full bore on NAFTA. So maybe the president felt he had to go full bore on the climate change issue with the Paris Accord.
Well, Chad, would he have been punished by his base if he had gone the other way on the Paris Accord and stayed in?
Well, he wasn't punished on NAFTA. That's the interesting thing. And so, you know, maybe he felt he had to throw a bone out there somewhere. And that's why this was so significant, was that this is probably, you know, the biggest overt policy shift that we've seen from this president, aside from maybe the immigration executive orders and things like that a few months ago.
Well, let's talk a little bit about something that is not climate related, because we'll be talking about climate all day, I'm sure. James Comey, former FBI director, expected to testify in Congress next week. Jesse, what are we expecting to see there? Fireworks?
Well, there will be a little bit of fireworks, but we have to keep in mind that James Comey is a lifelong prosecutor. He knows what he can and cannot say. He knows places where he can go and where he can't. So you'll see lawmakers trying to push him into push him into corners and push him into areas where they want him to talk about. You'll hear Republicans want to talk about unmasking, and you'll hear Democrats want to talk about Russia. But James Comey is not going to say anything that's going to put any investigation in trouble, because that's the life he's lived for so long. He's not going to set one foot out of line in his testimony.
Chad, do you agree with that? And what are you expecting from Comey next week?
Well, again, there has been consultation between Comey and also Robert Mueller, the special prosecutor here, and that there just the fact that that went on, which is appropriate, and we would expect that there's going to be certain things that James Comey is not going to be able to answer. This is something that's going to come up in closed sessions. There is a little bit of tension right now between the Senate Intelligence Committee and the Senate Judiciary Committee. Chuck Grassley, the Republican senator from Iowa, who chairs the Senate Judiciary Committee, along with Dianne Feinstein, the Democratic senator from California, were very upset that Comey was not going to come before their panel as the former FBI director. That is the Committee of Jurisdiction, and he's going before the Senate Intelligence Committee. There are some on Capitol Hill who think, even though there may be some fireworks, there may be some times where he doesn't answer questions, that it may come back to say, okay, let's do this in closed session. And I should point out something that was just announced. The Senate Intelligence Committee on Wednesday is going to have an open and closed hearing with the Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, McCabe, who's the number two at the FBI now, and also the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein. That's important because they're going to be dealing with FISA, which is the Special Surveillance Court, and the renewal of what we call 702, which is this area that's kind of a little vague that deals with domestic surveillance. You can imagine that there's going to be a lot of conversation at that hearing on Wednesday, the day before Comey appears, that deals with the unmasking issue.
And just,
that could be even more explosive.
That just got more complicated than that story already was. So
we do a lot of that this year, I noticed.
Yeah, exactly.
Real quick, Jesse, is there any chance that the president pulls executive privilege here to actually block Comey from going before Congress?
I've sort of given up on predicting what President Trump will or will not do, but there is always that possibility. Now, the question is, will James Comey, even if he tries to pull executive privilege, will James Comey accept that?
We heard from President Putin this week, Vladimir Putin. He did an interview with new NBC anchor Megyn Kelly. Let's take a listen to what he had to say.
Your girl, that is 3-year-old, can perpetrate such an attack. And they present it like this. They can pass it off like this, and these specialists can invent anything, and then they will blame someone else.
So, Jesse, he's saying there that a 3-year-old could have done the attack on the U.S. in terms of the hacking leading up to the election. What do you make of how he is behaving, how Putin is behaving, and how it plays here?
Well, let's just say I have an 8-year-old, and I don't think he could have pulled it off. I mean, he's good, but I don't know if he could have pulled that off. I mean, but honestly, what do you expect the leader of a foreign country that is sometimes considered an adversary to the United States to say? Do you expect him to actually say, yeah, we did it, and what you going to do about it? No, he's not going to say anything like that. So I don't take that as to mean actually anything, because even if Russia was officially behind it, they're not going to come on American television and say it. So I don't take those words to mean pretty much anything.
Well, look, even Hillary Clinton was talking about Russia. She was at the annual Recode conference in California. She complained that the Democratic Party data that she had during her campaign was mediocre to poor and non-existent, that it was wrong. But she also said this.
The Russians, in my opinion, and based on the intel and counterintel people I've talked to, could not have known how best to weaponize that information unless they had been guided.
Chad, it's interesting to hear Hillary Clinton's voice pop up in the news here. But what do you make of her comments on Russia first, and then also the fact that she really threw a lot of Democrats under the bus yesterday?
Well, she did because you talked about the data. Nobody really knew what was going to happen. I mean, I was told that on election night over at the Republican National Committee that as late as 9:30 that night, they thought that President Trump's electoral threshold, the highest he could get, was somewhere in the low 200s. You know, so none of this data is out there. It is interesting to hear, Clinton, when she's not walking in the woods, getting back into the public fray here. I will say, though, and this speaks to the Putin element of this, there are a lot of people to blame. There's a lot of situations that people could not have read and you know, this was almost an unmodelable election. That's what the pollsters will tell you. But that Vladimir Putin, at the end of the day, you have to remember that his background is in judo. He is a judo master, and he is a judo master politically as well. What that means is when you're in judo, you use your opponent's strength against you. And if Russia did meddle, well, that might have been part and parcel of what happened last fall.
Okay, we just have a few seconds left, but I just want to ask each of you just like a one-word answer here. Percentage chance that the American Health Care Act, the Republican health care bill, actually becomes law at this point as you see it, Chad?
Very tough, because the Senate doesn't have much time and they're going to get overrun by the debt ceiling, which is another conversation. And that's going to occupy most of the time this summer.
Jesse?
Extremely unlikely. I would almost say zero, but let's give it a 5%.
All right. Jesse Holland of the Associated Press and Chad Pergram of Fox News. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's get reaction to the president's decision to pull the United States out of the Paris climate deal. The Maldives is an island nation in the Indian Ocean. The highest spot anywhere on land is less than 8 feet. And scientists say rising sea levels could consume most of the country by the end of the century. Joining us now by Skype is Mohamed Nasheed. He's the former president of the Maldives, who's now living in asylum in the UK after he was ousted in a coup. President Nasheed, welcome.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, you famously held a cabinet meeting underwater to draw attention to the threat of climate change. What's your response to President Trump's plan to pull out of the Paris deal?
Well, the Maldives is just 1 meter above the sea level, and it's a very fragile country. Slight changes to climate has big impact on the Maldives. And we know it's not just the Maldives, it's a number of low-lying islands and coastal areas. President Trump has sentenced us to death, really, and we seem therefore now to be on death row. But my view is that the vast majority of the people of the United States, and we are seeing that through governors of big cities, mayors of big cities, coming out and saying that they are going to stick with the Paris Agreement. So we now have come to a situation where even if world leaders, even if presidents and prime ministers go against climate change issues, economics has decided, money has decided, the price mechanism has decided that this is the renewable energy is the way forward.
Well, look, President Trump said that it was not in America's economic interest to contribute to a $10 billion green climate fund. Now, I have a feeling this might be important to the Maldives because it helps developing countries respond to climate change. Here's the president.
Beyond the severe energy restrictions inflicted by the Paris Accord, it includes yet another scheme to redistribute wealth out of the United States through the so-called Green Climate Fund. Nice name.
President Obama already committed $1 billion to that fund before he left office. Trump is saying that he will cut that money off. But what would it do? What would that money do for countries like the Maldives?
The United States cannot come out from this agreement outside the agreement unilaterally. It's a sovereign agreement. So there's a world order issue here. There's a rule of law issue here. You have to stick to the agreement for 3 years. So I think there's confusion here when the president says that he's going to come out of the agreement. Now, and then secondly, on the green fund issue, that the United States is not willing to spend $10 billion of aid for adaptation programs. My view is that there is private capital also available. And of course, the seed money coming out from the green fund is necessary for countries like the Maldives. For us to build an embankment, it costs us $4,000 a meter. And we have 2,000 islands. So this is going to be hugely expensive. So in many senses, we are now already spending a good amount of our budget on adaptation programs. We are spending more than for education. We are spending more than for health on adaptation programs. And please understand, we did not do this. The people of the Maldives is not responsible. Low-lying islands are not responsible for climate change issues, but we are having to foot the bill. there's another bigger issue. And that's also for the developed countries and for the United States and for industrialized economies.
So is there a role for those countries to play? Do you think that there should be a response to the U.S. decision to pull out of this accord? Should they push, for example, for a carbon tariff or some other tough response on the United States?
I think the United States cannot leave the received world order. And even if the United States wants to relinquish world leadership in many, many areas, I'm sure there'll be other countries who would step in. Now, can we take United States responsible for leaving the agreement? Well, I think the world order has ways and means of how we may be able to make countries responsible. And yes, we must make countries responsible when you move out from what you have already previously agreed to.
I want to ask you one final question, and that is, is your government, the one that's in place now, because you were kicked out in a coup that was led by the former dictator of your country, is your country equipped to deal with this problem?
No, we do not have the necessary funds to adapt. We need to safeguard our shorelines. We need to get fresh water. We need to have a livelihood. Now, to do that, we must have assistance from developed countries. We're not asking for aid in that sense, but please understand, if that doesn't happen, what would happen is that a quarter of the world's population would start marching towards the United States and other developed countries.
Hmm. Mohamed Nasheed is the former president of the Maldives. He now lives under asylum in the United Kingdom. Mohamed Nasheed, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, Sunday marks the 28th anniversary of the bloody massacre in Tiananmen Square. It was June 4th, 1989. Chinese troops with rifles and tanks moved in on protesters in the square in Beijing. Estimates of the death toll range from several hundred to thousands. Joining us from Beijing is NPR's Anthony Kuhn. And Anthony, first of all, just remind us, what were these protests about in 1989?
They were about more democracy. They were about political reform. They were about less corruption. People really wanted the party out of their lives. You know, in China, hospitals, newspapers, factories all have Communist Party committees, and people just wanted them to step back. And during the 1980s, this was a political experiment. They were heading in that direction. But there was also a lot of debate at the top in Chinese leadership about which way to go. And in the end, the supreme leader, Deng Xiaoping, and the hardliners won out, and that experiment with separating the state from the party ended right there.
Has the Chinese government ever acknowledged the brutality of the crackdown on the protesters in Tiananmen Square?
Nope. It does not call it a pro-democracy movement. It calls it a counter-revolutionary rebellion. It emphasizes the brutality of people who were throwing rocks and bricks and things at the soldiers. And it says this: the army exercised great restraint, and it gives far lower numbers for casualties than the outside world.
Now, obviously, people in mainland China are not out protesting on the anniversary of something like this. But in the past, there have been demonstrations in Hong Kong. Are those still happening?
Yes, they happen every year. There are marches in the streets and candlelight vigils. But in the past couple of years, something really quite amazing has happened. And that is that a rift has appeared between the older generation that lived through 1989 and the younger kids. College students now are not participating in these protests. They see themselves as Hong Kong people, not Chinese. They think that, you know, there's just no use in trying to push democracy on China because China doesn't want it. And they have enough of their own troubles. In 2014, they had this thing called the Umbrella Revolution, pushing for freer elections, and that was quashed. So they really don't have any hope of changing China.
Anthony, when what happened at Tiananmen Square is discussed in China, what do people say about it?
The government's line remains to this day that the government was correct to take decisive action. If they had not done it, these protesters would have overthrown the government, there would have been chaos, and the past 28 years of fairly rapid economic growth would just never have happened.
If you were to go up to somebody on the street in Beijing and ask them about Tiananmen Square, what would their reaction be?
A lot of people would not know what I would be talking about because they never would have learned about it. It's been scrubbed from the internet and people are pretty much barred from talking about it. Some people would take the government's point of view that the government did the right thing. Others would just scurry away and not want to talk to me about it because there's no upside and it's just too risky.
Is there going to be any kind of ceremony on Sunday?
Well, you know, a lot of political activists have been taken on enforced vacations by the police, so they don't stage any commemorations. In recent years, people have even been prevented by the police from commemorating the event in their own homes. So really, Hong Kong and perhaps Taiwan and over other places overseas are the only places where there will be events remembering the 1989 Tiananmen Square massacre. And as we said, as time goes and the younger generation comes up, it seems that those remembrances are going to be shrinking.
Are there ever protests in mainland China these days that the government quashes?
Certainly. There are protests all the time, but they are not about making the central government more democratic. They're about resolving specific issues, and it's been this way for years. They're about local corruption. They're about demolition of homes. They're about people getting swindled out of their money by fraudsters. They're about pollution. They're about, crooked cops. These are all local issues, and the government has been very effective harnessing technology to make sure these people do not link up, making sure they do not use social media to organize street protests.
That's NPR's Anthony Kuhn in Beijing as we approach on Sunday the 28th anniversary of the massacre in Tiananmen Square. Anthony, thank you.
My pleasure, Jeremy.
It's been less than a month since Texas's governor signed a bill into law banning so-called sanctuary cities. The law says law enforcement officials must comply with federal immigration requests to detain immigrants, and officers must be allowed to ask about a person's immigration status. The city of El Cenizo has signed on to a lawsuit against the law, saying those requirements conflict with the way citizens in El Cenizo have lived for decades, side by side with people who entered the country illegally. Texas Public Radio's Ryan Poppy reports.
El Cenizo is a small border town with no traffic lights and two grocery stores, including Los Compadres Meat Market, where music fills the street outside. You can literally see the Rio Grande River, the dividing line between Texas and Mexico, from the highway. According to city records, 15 to 20% of the city's residents are undocumented. To protect them, El Cenizo passed a safe harbor ordinance back in 1999. It prevents local police and officials from questioning people about their immigration status. El Cenizo Mayor Raul Reyes says, with or without papers, immigrants living in his town are part of the community.
Who have their homestead in our community, who pay property taxes, why on earth would we try to hinder upon their rights and their livelihoods just because they don't have a piece of paper?
Miguel Trinero sits outside the meat market he owns, catching up on the big news in town with friends, the lawsuit their city filed in opposition to Texas's new sanctuary cities law. Governor Greg Abbott says that he signed the law to keep Texans safe from criminally dangerous immigrants. Trinero says that simply isn't a problem for him here in El Cenizo.
I think the citizens here rather respect the businesses that are here, you know, and they take care of the businesses. The people here are very passive, and I don't have much trouble as far as crime in my business.
Maria says that if Texas's sanctuary cities law is enforced, people in communities like El Cenizo will be at risk for detention and possible deportation for something as simple as a traffic violation. Luis Vera is an attorney with the League of United Latin American Citizens, or LULAC, the Latino rights group that filed the lawsuit.
In 1999, they established a safe harbor ordinance. That is, if you need somewhere to go and be safe, you can come to our town. We're not going to turn you into immigration officers. We're not going to report you. And now the state of Texas wishes to stomp them into the ground because they know that there's nobody to fight for them.
Mireya says that he's been accused of inviting criminal immigrants to his town with the safe harbor ordinance. But he says on a typical day, El Cenizo officers usually hand out just a ticket or two for minor traffic violations. Texas's sanctuary cities law would allow local police officers to question people about their immigration status during a routine traffic stop, even if no arrest occurs. It also financially punishes cities and counties that do not comply with all federal immigration detainer requests. Ro Vasquez owns K&K Groceries in El Cenizo. He worries that by being a plaintiff in the high-profile lawsuit, El Cenizo residents could become a target.
When you get into a lawsuit, you got to be careful. I mean, if tables can be turned the other way around,
we might be ending losing a lot of things here. You see, we got small funds or grants coming to the city.
But El Seniso officials hope their involvement in the lawsuit will highlight the U.S. Constitution's protection of individual and local rights so that U.S. citizens and people without documents can continue living side by side in this small town on the Mexican border. The state of Texas's ban on sanctuary cities is scheduled to go into effect on September 1st. Legal arguments for and against the law will likely be heard in court this summer. For Here and Now, I'm Ryan Poppy.
This is Here and Now. Musician Dan Auerbach got his start as one half of the band The Black Keys. The blues rock duo formed in 2001 in Akron, Ohio, with Patrick Carney on drums and Auerbach on guitar and vocals. The band became a popular and critical success, releasing 8 albums and earning 3 Grammys. Auerbach also made a name for himself as a solo artist and prolific producer for names like Dr. John, Grace Potter, Valerie June, and Connie Britton. Today, he releases his second solo record called Waiting on a Song. Dan joins us from Nashville, where he lives. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
And there's a lot to talk about, but first I just want to give people a little sense of the music. Here is a little bit from your single, Shine On You. Describe this sound, first of all.
I really wouldn't know how to describe it. There's little parts of all different kinds of music in there, I think.
Well, and different tracks sound like they're in different genres in a way.
Yeah, but somehow they all seem the same, too. It's hard to explain. I don't know. I stopped thinking about that about the time I started recording the record.
Hmm. Well, the album has been described as a love letter to Nashville. So tell us about that part.
Well, I mean, it was the first time that I'd ever really settled down in Nashville. Even though I've lived there 8 years, I'd been on the road most of the time touring. So, it was about last summer I made the decision not to tour. And that was when I really settled down into Nashville. I started doing some Nashville things that I'd never done before, like the songwriting sessions with different songwriters in town. It's such a Nashville tradition, but I'd never partook. So this was the first time for me, and I really loved it, and I took to it, and I sort of got addicted to it, and from those songwriting sessions came this record.
What did you love about it?
I just love the challenge of it. You know, when it works, what it can bring to the table, you know, just being able to write with somebody that you get along with. And this record, I got to work with so many people, you know, and every single person who played on the record was their own sort of magician, you know? So I was just kind of lucky to be able to be around that every day.
I hear that you wrote about 200 songs making this album.
Yeah, yeah. We recorded a couple hundred.
Wow. How do you, when you have a pool that big, how do you decide what stays and what goes?
Well, you know, I think I could have made a bunch of different albums from the songs. But there were a couple songs that I really knew I wanted to be on the record. And then from those, I let everything else connect to those. You know what I mean? So I think the song that I definitely wanted on there was Waiting on a Song. You know, that song was sort of upbeat. So every song that I picked to go with it kind of matched it. And all of a sudden I had like an upbeat, happy record. I didn't plan to.
Well, and I know that you and the band are prepared to play that for us. So let's listen here to Waiting on a Song.
One, two, three.
I've been thinking, I've been humming, I've been picking and I've been strumming just song. I've been hitching, I've been thumbing. I can almost hear one coming. I'm just waiting, waiting on a song. I look down in my pocket, underneath the bed. Walked under a lamppost and one hit me on the head. Am I blind or too dumb to see all the sounds surrounding me? I'm just waiting, waiting on a song. You'll be waiting, waiting on a song.
Well, tell us about this one, the title track.
The title track, that was one of the first ones that I wrote with Brian, and it's just three chords, like a lot of cowboy songs. They call them cowboy chords. But it was just, and it reminded, you know, because I grew up playing bluegrass music, and, you know, the Station Inn is in Nashville, and that's one of the reasons I moved to Nashville, is because I love that music. So it's just something about it felt so natural and reminded me of being at home, but felt like something altogether new. It was just a really good mix of feelings for me.
Now, you say you grew up playing bluegrass music. We also know that your mother was a classical piano teacher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she taught piano for a little bit. I never learned, though. I'm an idiot.
My father and mother are both classical pianists, and we had to learn. But I stopped when I was about 14. I realized I was never going to be as good as them. I'm going to get out of this business right away.
Well, you can still probably play a bit, right?
I can play, like, maybe the last piece that I learned, and that's about it.
For some reason I didn't. You know, my mom's family, they all played bluegrass, and she was like the odd duck. She liked classical music. So, I mean, I would play guitar. Her brothers taught me how to sing and play, and her sister Caroline. So, you know, I definitely learned from my mom's side of the family how to, you know, my love for actually playing music.
How did you meet Patrick Carney, your partner in the Black Keys?
Well, we knew each other from the neighborhood. We grew up right around the corner from each other. So, I mean, we went to the same middle school and high school. You know, we took the bus and everything. So we sort of knew each other before we actually knew each other. You know what I mean?
Did you know you had something there when you got together?
Yeah, the first time we got together, it was pretty immediate. You know, it just immediately sounded like music. Do you know what I mean? It sounded like something recognizable as maybe a song. You know? Mm. So that's sort of why we kept doing it, I think.
One of the things I saw about you was that you were performing in Paris on the night of the attacks at the Bataclan. You were at mm-hmm. a different venue, but not that far away. And there were people who were deciding whether to see you or see the group that was performing at the Bataclan.
Yeah.
The Eagles of Death Metal. What was that like?
It was horrifying. We had the same promoter. He'd been at that theater earlier in the night, and then he came to see us. And it was just you know, for us, it was surreal. I mean, we played a show. It was the best show of tour. We got backstage. We were elated. And then all of a sudden, we started seeing everyone's face backstage, and they were all frowning and sad. And then we heard the news, and it was just going from this extreme high to this extreme low. And it was scary, too, because, you know, we didn't really know what was happening, but we could hear the police sirens and the helicopters outside. And they locked up the building. It was wild.
And now we just had this attack at this concert in Manchester, England. Do you ever think about that when you're performing, that something like that could happen?
You know, we played 2 days after the show in Paris. It was our very last show of the whole tour. And we were in Italy, and that was... We definitely thought about it, that show, and everyone in the audience was. I mean, it was strange. But I haven't really performed too much since then, to be honest.
Hmm. Well, is there a song from the album that you'd like us to go out on?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Let's go out on Cherry Bomb.
Cherry Bomb. Here it is. And that is Dan Auerbach, who is half of the duo The Black Keys. His latest solo record is called Waiting on a Song. Dan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So if you ever go climbing,
Find a link to Dan's album and the full version of his live performance on our show at hereandnow.org.
Nearly 100 school districts in Oklahoma now have permanent three-day weekends. Lucky kids, right? Well, maybe not. The state of Oklahoma has slashed funding to public schools, forcing many of them to cut costs. Some school superintendents say they're happy with the new schedule. And Randy Harris is one of them. He's superintendent of Wagoner Public Schools outside of Tulsa. And Randy, welcome. Students in your district don't go to school on Mondays anymore, but you've also made the other school days an hour longer. So just, you know, remind us, how did you get to this point?
Yeah, our general fund right now is receiving $4 million less than we did 10 years ago, and we've only lost 110 kids. So we are hurting. We're strapped financially, and we knew we could save some money, some fixed costs by going to a four-day week.
Well, how much money does it save you? Because you still have to pay the teachers. I assume they're under contract.
Sure. The teachers and the support staff, we didn't cut their salaries at all. But obviously, we're not running buses one day a week, so that's less transportation, less fuel cost. And then also utilities is a big part. And what we discovered was substitute pay. We spent $95,000 the year before we did a four-day week on substitutes, and that equals about two teacher salaries. And so if we thought if we could increase teacher attendance, we could cut that in half, and that was our goal, and we actually met that. So I'm going to anticipate $120,000 in savings, which to us, that's almost three teachers.
Well, the Brookings Institution recently came out with a study about four-day school weeks in March. They found that they rarely save money and called the idea a contagion. The state of Oklahoma this year said that 9 of the 16 districts that they studied ended up spending more money than they had before. So, I mean, is there a chance that this could backfire?
Well, part of the research that I'm looking at when I do it, because I'm just looking at Wagoner Public Schools, some of the savings also were just intangibles. Our teachers in the state of Oklahoma have just been beaten down over the last few years, almost a decade, and our teach morale is incredibly high. We're able to recruit and retain some of the best and brightest teachers in the state, and we're very proud of that. Mm.
So it's a benefit for them, but what about for the students? Because there's not a lot of information out there about how this affects academics. I think there's one study from Colorado that says kids on a four-day school schedule, they did better in math, but then there's another study out from Montana that says performance starts pretty strong and kind of then fades off afterwards. Are you sure that this isn't hurting kids academically?
Well, we're not sure of anything. What's hurting us academically is, in just the schools in general, is the lack of funding in the state of Oklahoma. But the data that we've pulled, we pulled some at Christmas break, and what we found was surprising. Our reading scores in our elementary kids were up. Our discipline was down. Our attendance was up. But again, you're looking at one-year snapshot. You don't have any longitudinal data to pull from. And so... You know, the travesty in all this is how bad we continue to underfund education in the state of Oklahoma.
Sure, but it trickles down, right? Because you've got some low-income kids who maybe rely on a school lunch program, who have one less meal during the week. Some parents have to work 5 days a week. What are they going to do if their kid is suddenly has to stay home on Monday?
Sure. And we tried to address all of those as well. You know, the school is designed to give an education. We also worked with a nonprofit that provided child care on Mondays and before and after school as well for people that were low income. It was free. It was a very minimal charge for those that weren't. And we have 2,350 kids, and we only had at max capacity maybe 10 showing up on a day.
How typical is it, though, to have nonprofit partners step in? Because I'm thinking in a lot of neighborhoods where this happens, maybe across the country, they may not be so lucky.
You're absolutely right about that, and that's the thing. It's not a blanket fit that's going to help everybody. However, in our situation where we have some amicable partnerships and some great relationships with some nonprofits and some churches and local agencies, it has worked out really well for us. And we're really blessed and fortunate to be able to say that.
Your state superintendent of public instruction said that a four-day week is not a long-term strategy. But I wonder, for you if it will be, because if you decide that someday you want to take back that benefit and go to 5 days, you might have some upset teachers.
Oh, I'm not. Trust me, it won't just be the teachers. The kiddos are probably going to have a revolt as well on us. But you're absolutely right about that. But this is how dire our situation is. We have 5 school sites, and 2 of our sites don't have art teachers right now, which is a travesty. We have 5 school sites, and we only have 3 librarians full-time. We have library aides filling in spots at other libraries. When we get recouped with our money and we're able to fill those positions, now the problem becomes, are there even people left in the state of Oklahoma that we can pull from to put quality applicants back in those positions? So we're just trying to do the best that we can in Wagner and provide a wonderful opportunity. And it allows us to reach out and develop some partnerships with people that may not exist in other communities.
That's Randy Harris, superintendent of Wagoner Public Schools there outside of Tulsa. Randy, thank you very much for joining us.
You bet.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.